The first talk, this talk is not directly related to loop quantum gravity. I'll start by giving some historical remarks. What I'm presenting here continues a line of thought that started in the 70s with Penrose, Pribansky, and mathematicians Atiyah, Hitch, and Zinger, who realized that notion of self-duality plays a very important role in four-dimensional GR. Then, of course, in the 80s, Hamiltonian formulation that was based on the self-dual connection was discovered by Ashtekar. In the 90s, first attempts at pure connection formulation of GR were made by Capovilla, Dell, Jacobson. Then there was work by Bengtsson on neighbors of GR and ideas by Peldan on unification by enlarging the gauge group. So the recent developments just continue that same line of thought. And I've listed some people who work on this more recently. So it's gravity conference. So it's, of course, I'm talking about gravity. But instead of deriving what I'm going to present from GR, I'd like to take top-to-bottom approach and ask you to forget everything you know about GR. If you cannot do this, then I have, well, let me imagine that there is some civilization that did not discover Newtonian gravity and did not discover Einsteinian gravity, but they did discover quantum mechanics, field theory, well, standard model, and everything we know apart from gravity. And let me imagine that these people also know about topological quantum field theory. So they know that it's possible to do quantum field theory in the absence of any metric. And this is the game I'm going to play. I'm going to present or start by constructing a very large family of theories. I'll call them different variant gauge theories. They're gauge theories which are constructed, but they don't use any metric. They're not Jan-Mills theories. So the main idea is that, well, we have a curvature of a connection. This works for any gauge group, so my gauge group is not yet specified. I have curvature of connection, and then I'm going to construct some functional, which is nonlinear function of the connection, or I'm going to construct some nonlinear function out of the curvature of the connection. The way one does it is, well, it's described here. Let me see if I have a pointer. Well, yeah. Actually, let me write some equations on the board. So imagine you want to construct, you want to understand why this quantity, square root of the determinant of G integral, we know that it's, well, it's a volume of a manifold. It makes sense. It's a diffeomorphism invariant quantity. But let me try to forget about the fact that this is a metric and just think, so imagine I start from symmetric rank 2 tensor, and I want to construct a quantity which I can integrate over the manifold, and I don't have anything else in my disposal. So what I do, I have to contract all the space-time indices in some way. So I'll take two epsilon tensors, mu nu or sigma, epsilon alpha beta gamma delta, and I'll put mu alpha g sigma delta. This is, of course, just the determinant of G. But the way I've written it, it makes it obvious that we're not using any structure that we don't have. These quantities, these epsilons, they have components plus minus one in any coordinate system. And this is what is denoted by this tilde. They're densities. So this quantity makes sense. And it's also obvious that this is density weight two quantity. So to be able to integrate, we need to take a square root out of it. And then this is density weight one. We can integrate it over the manifold. So I'm going to play the similar game, but with the curvature. If I have a curvature, I can construct quantity, which is epsilon mu nu rho sigma FF. And now this is a matrix. I'll call it, well, if I put the 1/4 here, this is a matrix XIJ tilde. It's density weight one matrix. And so to be able to construct some quantity which I can integrate over the manifold, I just need to construct a number out of this matrix. And this is what this function F does for me. So let me consider a function which maps matrices into numbers. And my matrices are G tensor G. Curvature F is Lie algebra value 2 form. So this matrix X takes values in Lie algebra across itself and it's symmetric. So let me consider functions which map matrices to numbers and let them be homogeneity degree 1 functions and let them be gauge invariant. Then it's fairly obvious that, just by applying homogeneity degree 1 guarantees that I can apply my function F to the matrix and I will get a number which is density weight 1 just because of homogeneity, and this number is gauge invariant. And so I define the action of my function F on curvature wedge itself, in this way. And this quantity is now well-defined four form, which I can integrate. So this is my action. My action is I fix some function F, I'll call it defining function, and I apply it to curvature wedge itself. And I integrate this 4-4 over the manifold. This is a class of theories that I'm going to talk about. Now, what are properties of these theories? The easy thing to see is that the field equation that follow by varying that action with respect to connection is a statement that some 2-form, which is constructed from the curvature, is covariantly constant. And this object here is constructed from the curvature, so it's first order in derivatives of the connection, and then one is applying one more derivative. So the field equations are second order in derivatives, which is a good property, because, anything higher than second typically leads to instabilities. Then one can compare these field equations to Maxwell, or to Jan-Mills. In Jan-Mills, Jan-Mills' field equation is a very similar statement. It's a statement that some two-form is covariantly constant. But of course, in the case of Jan-Mills, one constructs this two-form but by using the Hodge dual, and Hodge dual uses the metric. We don't have a metric, and instead we construct some two-form out of the curvature. It's kind of a twisted. There is some metrics which is twisting the curvature two-form, and this is what is field equations require that to be covariantly constant. Then one can do Hamiltonian analysis for this theory and check that this is dynamically non-trivial theory. Gauge group of dimension n, this theory has 2n minus 4 propagating degrees of freedom. This theory is a gauge theory, the gauge transformations acting on the fields in the usual way, and it's also diffeomorphism invariant. One can check it explicitly that, also by construction, it's obvious that theory is going to be diffeomorphism invariant. So this is my theory. Let me also mention that what I presented is second order formulation, because field equations are second order. If you don't like second order formulations, there is also first order formulation, which is available. And the action is similar. It's of BF type. One adds a potential for the B field. Then if one integrates out the B field, one is back to the second order formulation in terms of the connection only. Then the next question I would like to address is, are there any such theories? Well, if one takes the gauge group U1, then F wedge F is not a matrix. F doesn't have a Lie algebra index. So F wedge F is just a 4-form. And the only function one can construct out of this is, F wedge F itself. Integrating that gives a trivial theory. This is total divergence, so one does not get any dynamically non-trivial theory. But already for the case of SO3 or SU2, F wedge F becomes a 3x3 symmetric matrix. It's the function F, which I'm applying to this matrix, is gauge invariant, so I can always represent my X as, I can diagonalize by an orthogonal transformation, and then I know that function F is just a function of eigenvalues. And because it's homogeneous degree 1, I can always write it when lambda 1 is not equal to 0 in this form. And so I immediately see that I have lots of such functions. Basically, I have as many functions as there are functions of 2 degrees of freedom. as their functions of two variables. So let me now understand what these theories are. So far, this was just a description of the theories. To understand what they are for SU2, I will introduce a metric. So this will be my link to GR. To introduce this metric, well, the construction of the metric relies on an isomorphism, which is it's a famous isomorphism, SO6SL4. And, well, let me describe you how one proves this isomorphism, because, well, in the proof, one uses two forms, and two forms are very basic for what I'm doing here. So that isomorphism is proved by considering the space of two forms in R4, and one has a metric in that space. It's the same metric constructed using the epsilon tensor. It's the wedge product metric. Taking wedge forms, two forms, one can wedge them together and obtain four forms. So dividing by the, say, by arbitrary four form, one can construct a metric on two forms. If one does everything over R, this metric is signature 3-3. And then group SL4 acts on two forms in the usual way. And of course, it's going to preserve the wedge product metric. So this immediately shows that SL4 is the same as, because SL4 acts and preserves some metric on six-dimensional space, SL4 is the same as, well, SO6. Now, but then one can remember that the space of metrics is the same as its quotient space, SL4 mod SO4. It's a space of frame fields, and SL4 can map any frame field into any other by doing this. So space of metrics is space of frame fields mod just the rotation of the frame. So these are conformal metrics. And, well, if I took GL4, it would be the space of all metrics. But here I'm talking about SL4. This is metrics mod conformal mod vial rescalings. This is 9 components per point. And then because SO4 is the same as SO3 cos SO3, and on the other hand, this space is a Grassmannian. It's a point in this space is a choice of a three-dimensional plane in the six-dimensional manifold of two forms. So this tells me that conformal metrics are in correspondence with choices of three-dimensional planes in the six-dimensional manifold of two forms. And, well, it's clear that this has something to do with self-duality, because SO4 is SO3 cos SO3. It's a self-dual, anti-self-dual split. So I can summarize all this by saying that conformal metrics can be encoded into knowledge which two forms are self-dual. And here is an explicit formula of this sort. If I have three two forms, I can construct a certain metric out of them. This is a Banke formula. And this metric is constructed in such a way that these two forms that I started from are self-dual in this metric. And it's a conformal metric. You see, I'm defining it only mode conformal rescalings. So this is construction of metrics by triples of two forms. And now let me come back to this gauge theories. So remember that, again, gauge theory started, it was gauge theory, and the action was specified by a function f of a matrix. So I'm going to use all this information to construct a certain metric. So I have curvature two forms, of which there is three of them, because Lie algebra is three-dimensional. I'm going to declare these two forms to be self-dual, and by the previous construction, this gives me conformal metric. And then I'm constructing volume form just by, well, I'm taking the function f that defines my theory and just declaring the volume form to be multiple of this. And I need some dimensionful parameter there, because volume form is dimensionless, and this quantity is dimensionful, because I'm thinking of curvature as being dimensionful quantity. And so my action is just the volume form for the case of SU2, which is what I'm doing now. My action is just the volume of the manifold computed with respect to this metric. Then the first claim is that there is a particular value for this function f when this theory, this gauge theory, is just GR. And on the next slide, I'm going to explain you what does it mean that it's just GR. But the claim is that with this function f, one gets GR with cosmological constant, with non-zero cosmological constant. And, well, this statement that it's a unique parity invariant member of the family, I'm going to explain a little later when I talk about perturbation theory. But, so what is this statement? The statement is that if one looks at connections satisfying their field equations, which are some second order PDEs for the connection, if you take a connection like that and you construct the metric as I indicated, then that metric is going to be Einstein with non-zero scalar curvature. And in the opposite direction, if you take an Einstein metric with non-zero scalar curvature, take self-dual part of Levi-Civita connection for it, it's going to satisfy this equation. So this is the relation to GR. And there is a caveat. This works for metrics for which the self-dual part of Riemann curvature is invertible almost everywhere. So for example, it will not work in the Euclidean, well, it will not work for Minkowskian metrics, because for Minkowskian metric, the curvature is zero. So this construction cannot describe that, but Minkowskian are not constant scalar curvature. But even for constant scalar curvature metrics, there are examples of that. For example, S2 cross S2 is one example. Then this matrix is not invertible anywhere. So these metrics are not covered. So what is covered by this construction are metrics, generic metrics, as I said, for which this is almost everywhere true. There can be surfaces where this is not true, and this is fine, but it must cannot be any regions where this matrix is not invertible. X is wedge F. It's something constructed from the curvature. And on shell, this X becomes exactly this quantity. So this is why, as you can see, there is 1 over X or 1 over square root of X in field equations. And this is why this must be invertible. So this is one way to see that these gauge theories have something to do with gravity. And now I'm going to describe another way, which is much more general, and which is via perturbation theory. So let's now again forget everything about GR. And if you like, you can even forget about the equivalence to GR that I just described. Let's just take these gauge theories again and try to understand what they are without introducing any metric. So I'm taking some connection which is symmetric enough. Well, to expand this theory around, I cannot take a zero connection. Zero connection is a bad point to expand around. So I need a non-zero connection. And I'll take a connection which is homogeneous and isotropic. So I'm thinking about space as being foliated by some hypersurfaces. Connection is the same on every hypersurface, and it can depend on time if it likes. It's also isotropic. And, well, it's very easy to write such a connection. It's SU2 connection. Curvature and matrix of F wedge F. The important thing about this matrix is that for this particular background connection, the matrix is proportional to identity matrix. Then it's very easy to see that this connection, actually for any function A of t, satisfies the field equations. So it's a solution of field equations for any theory. This follows from the fact that field equations are df by dx. Fj is equal to zero. And when x is delta ij, this matrix is also delta ij, is proportional to delta ij, and so this becomes just Bianchi identity. So this is a solution, and it's very symmetric, so it's a good choice of background to expand around. I do this. If I remember about the construction of a metric from the connection, I'll find that this connection, in fact, is De Sitter space. The corresponding metric is De Sitter space metric. But I don't have to to remember about this. I can just take the theory and expand. Then I get an action of this sort. Well, here I'm using the metric. So yeah, so let me introduce the metric, and then sigma i's are going to be self-dual, the basis of self-dual two forms for that metric. Yes. Well, this is not scale factor of the sitter. So maybe you're confused by that. This A is just A of t, it's some function of time. It's not what the... If you make some good choice of time coordinate, then it becomes a scale factor. But at this level, it's reparametrization invariant. I'm free to choose any time I like. So it's not exactly the scale factor. You have to do some more assumptions to make it into scale factor. Mm-hmm. Well, yes. In fact, to get Lorentzian signature, I would need to put an I here. Yeah. Yes. Anyway, so by introducing the metric, which is defined by this background connection, I can put my linearized action for perturbations in this form. Then I find just from general properties of I know that this is homogeneity degree one function. I can show that on this particular background, which is x equal to delta ij, matrix of second derivatives of the function f is necessarily proportional to projector on spin two representation. It can be shown very quickly. It just follows. For any function f, this is true. And so this is linearized Lagrangian for an arbitrary function f. It's always the same linearized Lagrangian. That's important. And then I can, for example, do Hamiltonian analysis and quickly convince myself that these are spin two particles. Excitations of the gauge field are spin two particles. So one again sees that these theories for SU2, they're gravitational theories, they describe spin two. And moreover, one sees that this is true for any choice of function f. I already told you that for a particular function f, one gets GR, but for any choice of function f, this is gravity theory. In the sense that it's about massless spin two particles interacting in some way. Yeah, then this is zero. And so you just, well, it's, yeah, you don't have any degree. So this is a special point, but for generic function f, there are degrees of freedom and there are spin two particles. Let me also say a few words about what kind of description of gravity this is. I don't have any time to go into details, but, so first of all, this is description which uses, well, these are some spinner notations. S plus is, say, unprimed spinners. S minus is prime spinners. One can, it's best to understand what this linearized connection is by describing everything in terms of spinners. And then one finds that the representation of Lorentz group that is used here to describe gravitons is this chiral representation, S plus 3, S minus. And in the usual metric description, it's this representation that we use. So it's a different representation of Lorentz group that is used. It's still spin 2. But of course, it's a chiral representation. There are no real objects. If one works in Lorentzian signature, there are no real objects of this sort. And so fields are necessarily complex valued. And parity invariance is not manifest. But then what happens is that in this formulation, if one does perturbation theory and continues to expand further and further, vertices, interaction vertices of these gravitons are very simple. They're much simpler than in the usual metric description. One also finds that the action that I described is convex, unlike the Einstein-Hilbert functional of GR. And, well, it's basically related to the fact that this is volume of some space. So it's actually non-negative functional, and it's convex. One can prove very general statements just taking this functional. So, for example, the statement one can prove is that any Einstein metric of non-zero scalar curvature, of negative scalar curvature, there are no Einstein deformations nearby. One can prove it using this functional, and this is a new statement. It wasn't known before. So just using the convexity of this functional. Now let me go and describe some other, well, let's continue to explore what these theories are about. We already know that for SU2, they're gravitational. Let's enlarge the gauge group. Then I cannot play the game of defining a metric anymore, because now I have, in the case of SU2, I had just three two forms, and there was a natural metric that I could construct. For a GNL gauge group, there are too many two forms, so I cannot construct the metric in any natural way. So the only thing I have access to is perturbation theory. And then there is a natural class of backgrounds. It's a similar type of backgrounds as we've described for SU2, but now the background is specified by embedding of SU2 into a larger gauge group. So, and given such an embedding, there is a background. One can check that this is a solution of field equations. And so let me expand around these backgrounds. But now there are many of them because gauge group became larger. I can embed in different ways. And then it's very easy calculation that, typically for larger gauge group, there will be part of the gauge group which commutes with the SU2 that you embedded inside. So here is example of SU3, there is a U1 that will commute with this SU2. So typically, but not always, of course, you can embed SU2 in such a way that there is nothing commuting with it, but typically there is. And then a very easy calculation, one can check that a linearized Lagrangian for connections in those directions which commute with SU2, one gets this linearized Lagrangian. This matrix, just again from general properties, it follows that it's a delta ij, well, it's a metric on Lie algebra of SU2 times the metric on the part of the Lie algebra which commutes with SU2. So it becomes Jan Mills plus a surface term. So one immediately finds that on these backgrounds, if you embed SU2 into a larger gauge group, SU2 will continue to describe gravitons, but what commutes with SU2 are Jan-Mills gauge fields. One can also check interactions of these Jan-Mills gauge fields. One indeed, it's really Jan-Mills. So one gets a unification mechanism of the type that was studied by, well, that was contemplated by many people before. Any gauge group. You take a large gauge group. You embed SU2 inside. There is a part which commutes with SU2. U1. And then, of course, there is more than just in that Lie algebra. There is SU2 part, what commutes with it, and other stuff. This other stuff is somewhat exotic, and one can find that it typically describes massive fields. But in any case, one finds that these gauge theories for large gauge groups, they provide a mechanism for unification of gravity with Jan-Mills. And one can call it internal Kaluza-Klein type mechanism, because in the usual Kaluza-Klein one enlarges the number of dimensions of space-time. Here one would be enlarging the number of internal dimensions, the gauge group. And it's quite simple, and I hope you have appreciated how simple this mechanism is, because I haven't made any assumptions at all. My only assumption is that, well, let's start by considering this diffeomorphism in invariant gauge theories. And then you just follow the logic and you find that gravity and Jan-Mills is inside. Of course, yeah. This I'm not resolving here. Okay, and then let's talk about quantum. What these theories are quantum mechanically. Well, very little is known, unfortunately. One can study quantum theory by doing perturbation theory around a fixed background. And this is what I'm doing at the moment. There are some results already, but there is nothing. Well, the interesting results, if you're interested in this formulation, but there is nothing that is worse. I mean, there is no key conceptual result that I can present here, so I'm not discussing these technical results. Basically, one can do it, and it's not hard. It's easier than in the usual metric formulation of GR. It's hard to go further than perturbation theory, because one has to quantize in the absence of the metric. These are now really like topological field theories. One simply doesn't have any metric in them. So how does one quantize them in the absence of a metric? And I'm still I'm still thinking about this problem. So one can call them, these are TQ of T's in the sense that there is no metric, but with local degrees of freedom. And then maybe lattice simulations can help on this, because these actions are convex actions. They don't have a conformal mode of Euclidean gravity problem. And let me describe you my quantum field, well, quantum theory hopes. What's the best case scenario here? The best case scenario, first one should note that these theories are non-renormalizable in the usual sense, in the sense of perturbation theory, of course, because, well, if one expands them, one finds that there is a coupling constant of negative mass dimension. But then one could hope that, because this is a very large class of theories, this is infinitely large class of theories, because even for the case of SU2, the class of these theories is infinitely large, because it's parametrized by functions of two variables. One could hope that this class is closed by renormalization. So whatever quantum corrections or whatever counterterms you have to add are already included. And in particular, the simplest possible checks, like we know that in GR, Riemann cube term appears at two loops. So Riemann cube term is included here. This can be checked easily. So this is possible thing to hope for, but I don't know whether this is true. And so the hope would be that the physics at high energies continues to be described by members of the same class of theories. Dynamics changes, but degrees of freedom don't. That's the hope. And then one could hope to study the RG flow explicitly in this realization. One could speculate that maybe we know that at low energies, the relevant function f is that of GR, and it's a very strange function. It has, if I go back, show you this function again, it has one of G lambda in front, so it has an extremely large number in front of this, in front. So it's, one can say it's a very peaked type of function, peaked type of potential. One could speculate that maybe as one flows to the EV, the potential becomes flatter and flatter, and one arrives maybe at a topological point. Topological point is, of course, fixed point of any possible renormalization group flow, so maybe this is what is happening. This is just a speculation. And here is my summary. So I described to you dynamically non-trivial diffeomorphism in engaged theories, which is a very large class. Then I told you that for SU2, this is gravity. And this is simple derivation of gravity. You don't have to assume anything. We all know that gauge theories are important, and we just add diffeomorphism invariance, and we get gravity back. GR can be described in this language. One gets a bounded from below Euclidean action. This is computationally efficient alternative to the usual description. If I have time, I'll show you what vertices look like. I have a slide after this. One can unify gravity with Jahn-Mielsen, this framework, and this is internal Kaluza-Klein unification, how one can refer to this. And then if this class of theories is closed under normalization, then there is hope for understanding what happens in the EV staying in this framework. But there are many open problems. There are three. One of them is, this is chiral description, and one works with complex fields necessarily, and therefore unitarity is not obvious. These actions are complex. And so unitarity is not under control here. I don't understand unitarity myself. But of course, I told you that GR can be put in this language, and GR is a unitary theory. So these theories managed, at least for one of them, they managed to be unitary. But I don't know what happens for the other members of the class. Then another big problem is, of course, coupling to fermions. Well, to matter in general, but matter, I told you that some bosonic matter can be naturally added to the picture, but fermions, I don't know whether they can be added. And of course, if they cannot be added in any natural way, then this is not interesting. But there are hopes, there are some ideas how this can be done. And, the third problem is, of course, quantum mechanically. How do they behave? Can they have nice UV behavior? I'll stop here.
About this closeness under renormalization, is it related to the asymptotic safety scenario?
Yeah, it would
be. And could it guide it towards some numerical test of this issue?
Well, for me, this would be realization of asymptotic safety scenario. Guide to some numerical realization, maybe on the lattice. One can put these theories on the lattice, on computers, and then see what happens. Because these are gauge theories. They're different variant, but they're normal SU2 gauge theories. So usual lattice field theory techniques. That I don't know. I don't know this.
Yeah, I think that this points out the significance of chirality because you didn't emphasize, but could be emphasized that the same game played with the non-chiral Lorentz and full Lorentz group variables leads to bimetric theories and instabilities and all sorts of issues, as you've emphasized. So I'd like to ask if, as you're developing perturbation theory, there is, of course, the opportunity to test quantum gravity by parity breaking effects in the CMB. And is that something you can focus on?
These other members of the class, the ones that are not GR, are parity violating. One can see this explicitly. And actually, I didn't say it, but GR is the only member of the family which is parity invariant. So this is how one could discover GR, just by starting with gauge theories and seeing that they describe, for the case of SO2, they're gravitational, and then you look for parity invariant member, and you would find GR this way. But I didn't try to do any physics with this parity violation. This is all I know. What I said is all I know.
So, one of the things that makes the metric in GR and not just right. some random tensor is the fact that matter moves along geodesics.
Right.
And the second thing, which is closely related, is that it couples universally to all matter.
Right.
Now, you've said that you don't know how to couple all kinds of matter, but you do know some matter
yes.
couplings. Do you get a universal coupling?
Yeah,
do you get
this,
geodesic
this is this,
motion?
Yeah, this is this symmetry breaking mechanism. As soon as you choose a background, which is specified by SU2 embedding into a larger gauge group. This breaks symmetry and makes this SU2 special, universal, and everybody else couples universally to this SU2. So there is some universality mechanism which is part of this scenario.
In unimodular gravity, you fix the conformal factor,
right.
but then there's always a question about whether this is conserved by loop corrections. Would you say that your approach is also a way to solve this problem because you flashed on the fact that this conformal mode does not propagate also?
Yeah, this is a very
loops.
Interesting description of gravity. So if you look at this functional, you can view it as a functional in the space of metrics. Well, it's a volume of a certain metric. This is what the functional is. A metric is constructed from the gauge field. But you can quickly convince yourself that curvature has 12, sorry, connection has 12 components. Metric that you constructed from the connection is gauge invariant, and therefore metric is specified by 12 minus 3 components. So what one has here is connection specifies full metric, but you cannot vary the conformal factor independently. Conformal factor is fixed. This is how this functional works. The functional is functional in the space of conformal classes of metrics. But this theory is not conformally invariant in the sense that one can freely rescale it. Conformal factor is just fixed. Oh, this I don't know. And I'm not even sure that there exists a relation to unimodular gravity here.
So in the 80s, right? I mean, one of the guiding principles was also that in the Hamiltonian formulation, that you look at the Young-Mills phase space
right.
and write down some equations which are gauge invariant and diffeomorphism invariant.
Mm-hmm.
But their diffeomorphism was just three-dimensional one.
Mm-hmm.
And the simplest things you can write down are precisely the Gauss constraint, the vector constraint, and the Hamiltonian constraint. I mean, your generalization is vastly superior because it's in space-time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if there are similarly this because it is in space-time, mm-hmm. You might be able to use it even in the classical theory, yes. Namely, for example, doing perturbation theory or using numerical relativity, people had used the connection variables for that, but mm-hmm. and they could show that, in fact, it's a global hyperbolic system and such mm-hmm. thing, but not much progress happened. Would this be better? Because you're coming from
space. It might be better because something very interesting happens here with Diffeo constraints in this formulation. Diffeo constraints are trivial. Diffeomorphism constraints are trivial to solve in this formulation. They are just algebraic constraints on the connection. And what they tell you is that, well, you should just forget about some components of the connection. They're not differential equations. The only differential equations that appear here are Gauss constraints. So this is something very interesting about this formulation.
What about quantum anomalies? Can the diffeomorphism symmetry be destroyed by that? Have you checked out? This depends on the...
Can be. Various. Has to be checked, of course. But I didn't check it.
I just want to make a remark about your first slide. Mm-hmm. So in the way I think about general relativity, ordinary GR, it already is a gauge theory in the sort of general sense that with the degrees of freedom that you work with, the metric, there two different metrics can correspond to exactly the same physical situation. And I think historically, GR was the first gauge theory. I mean, I think the development of what we now call gauge theories in particle theory was inspired by the example of general relativity. So in your first slide, maybe if we hadn't discovered general relativity, I mean, particle physics owes this great debt to relativity, I think. It's hardly ever acknowledged for whatever reason, can imagine. Maybe we wouldn't have discovered.
But wouldn't you call Maxwell first gauge theory?
Without GR.
Wouldn't you call Maxwell first gauge theory?
But the
Maxwell is one gauge field.
The understanding of it as a gauge theory, though.
Well, my meaning of gauge theory here is that it's gauge theory about, well, principal G bundles over the manifold.
I understand you're using it in a narrower sense, but to me, I think of GR as a gauge theory in the sense that there are different descriptions of the same, different mathematical descriptions of the same physical.
But one thing that underlies this, maybe I should say it, metric gravity is unlike all other theories we know. It's, well, the Lagrangian is different, the field metric is different. And so here one manages to describe gravity by a field which looks much more like all other fields. One may dislike it, one may have prejudices, one may say that, well, GI is about geometry of space-time, and this is very important about it, but a different description is possible, and this is what I wanted to say.
Okay, it's time for break, so let's thank Speaker Wing.